This is June 26th, 2016, and we're just approaching the weekend commemoration of our 50th anniversary. I've been, like so many of us here at the center, I've been exceptionally busy lately and coming up with a Taisho topic was something that seemed like it'd be hard to squeeze in, but suddenly I realized that I can just do an overview of these 50 years, just picking out certain themes these 50 years using the timeline, a copy of the, a spreadsheet that we're using to create a timeline. There'll be a 56-foot-long timeline in the backyard of the here at the Zen Center Elm Park. Tom Cole has been working day and night on refining this timeline with many, 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 many photographs and other notes. And I'm going to be using that text this morning and going through things to jump right to the overarching theme of these 50 years. It is adaptation. What is it that enables anyone to survive for 50 years or longer? It's adapting to changing circumstances and conditions. When Roshi Kaplow came back from Japan after 13 years of training there, he faced a very unfamiliar country. He had grown up here, of course, but having been away that long, he had to adjust to his own home country, which had changed dramatically during the from 1953 to 1966. And it's a credit to him, especially, that he was able to put in place the basic forms that the rest of us have been able to build on. One of the, I think, the great distinctions of Roshi Kaplow as compared to at least most other first-generation Zen teachers, Japanese and American, is his insistence from the beginning that we have to find Western forms for this historically Asian tradition. In our annual meetings of the Zen, American Zen Teachers Association, this is the central mission we all agree is ours, which is to find ways to adapt an Asian tradition to the West. Even within Asia, long ago, this is a process that had to happen. The Japanese Japanized Chinese Zen, Chan. The Koreans, the same. So there are differences among the three East Asian Zen traditions, Chinese, Japanese, and Korean. But compared to the changes that we have to shepherd, they're much more superficial, I think it's fair to say. Why? Because these three Asian countries all share a Confucian background. And the United States is anything but Confucian. In fact, there's no Western country that you could call having any Confucian nature to it. So there's a lot that Chinese, Japanese, and Korean Buddhism, Zen, have in common that we have to find a way to let go of if it's not helpful, if it's not true. The essence of Zen is not Asian. The essence of Zen is not Western. The essence of Zen is beyond East and West. It's really the task before all of us, not just teachers, but to realize this essential nature of Zen and everything else. What's that essence? Well, it's not a thing. It's not a form. This is why it is really vital to have realized the formlessness of form, the formlessness of this world of phenomena, in order to adapt the Dharma to the West through skillful means, to do it through wisdom. Otherwise, there's the danger of clinging to Asian forms where they're not really suitable for us. This is what caused sort of the basic rupture in our own lineage. The Rochester Zen Center Kaplo lineage was this very matter, where way back 50 years ago, when things were just getting started here, where Roshi Kaplo and his teacher Yasutani Roshi butted heads over adapting certain ways of adapting Zen to America. There, no doubt, there were other things. There was some backstory, possibly even I believe stretching back to Philip Kaplow's family of origin, issues that had come to the surface that he was facing for the first time in his relationship with this father figure, Yasutani Roshi. But the immediate causes included Roshi Kaplow's insistence on translating the Prajnaparamita into English, chanting it in English. Yasutani Roshi insisted that we should keep it in Japanese. And Roshi Kaplo had the cojones then to say, look, in Japan, it's chanted in Japanese. In China, it's chanted in Chinese. In Vietnam, it's chanted in Vietnamese. In Korean, it's chanted in Korean. Why should we not chant it in English? Yes, Tani Roshi was a fierce and I would have to say autocratic, was a fierce and autocratic teacher, and he didn't brook this kind of disagreement from his disciple. There were other things I've heard, you know, for all the time I spent at Roshi Kaplow's side, he never really talked about everything that went into that split with Yasutani Roshi in 1965 or 66. I've heard stories about the very first sesshin south of here in Painted Post, New York, I think it is, right near the Pennsylvania border, where at that time they were sitting, it was just a rented retreat center, and for that sesshin led by Yasutani Roshi, assisted by Philip Kaplow, they sat on the floor. They didn't have these platforms, this tan that we're sitting on. And Philip Kaplow had placed the kyosaku, the encouragement stick, which is always put on the altar, had put it on the floor in front of him when he was monitoring, and that was something that Yasutani Roshi reamed him out for. So there was a difference of sensibilities between the very formal Yasutani Roshi. The Japanese, as a whole, generally speaking, are more formal than Americans. And he was already sort of shifting into the more casual American style. And that became a sore point between them. Along the same lines, after the split, when Roshi Kaplow was on his own here and we'd become our own independent center, Roshi Kaplow insisted that we keep to a minimum the number of things that are displayed here that are in calligraphy. I've been to other Zen centers, of course, for various reasons, and there's that, and there's also he made a very conscious effort to find English equivalents for Japanese terms whenever possible. We could probably go further than that. There's a certain habit energy where we get used to, those of us who have been here for a while, we get used to using the Japanese. Maybe we could do a little better with that. But some things are just can't be translated. There are no English words. For example, the Roksu. Here's a little thing. At every other Zen center I've been, they've kept to the Japanese form of the round cushion, of having no strap. But early on, before I got here, all of our round cushions had straps that make it easier to carry. You can carry eight of them, four in each hand, just by looping through the straps. This, I think, is there something American about that? The practicality, the convenience of carrying cushions with straps. I would never want to change that. Having been in Japan and finding that how many cushions you can carry without straps. One of the challenges that Roshi Kaplow used to talk about was having a Buddha figure with a Western face. Again, there's no Buddha. The word Buddha, remember, the word Buddha just means enlightenment or the enlightened one. And Asia hasn't cornered the market, never cornered the market on enlightenment. We're all inherently enlightened. And so what is an American face? These countries, Japan especially, but also Korea and China, were historically homogeneous, very, very, very homogeneous societies, unlike ours. Unlike our melting pot of so many different ethnicities and races and all. And so a Buddha made in Japan would have the features, had Japanese features, and this likewise in China and Korea. But what is the American face? Any face you give a Buddha figure will exclude an ethnicity or a bunch of ethnicities or races. And so he finally, shortly before I took over the center, he commissioned a sculptor in Canada, John Fillion, to make this large Buddha figure that has been in our backyard ever since. It's made of, this compound is called cement fondue. That's something to tell your friends if you're looking at it. But it has... It has disadvantages to it. It's a little harder to relate to with these. It has just the barest suggestion of facial features. But you can't have it both ways. If you're going to give it facial features, what face features do you give it? And so we have this Buddha, this teaching that our Buddha nature, that we all have in common equally, that we are all endowed with, this is beyond any ethnicity or race or even sex. The figure was deliberately fashioned under Roshi's instructions to be a little ambiguous in the way it's as if it's erupting from the earth, from the rock. And even that is not specifically male or female. I'm going to just pluck a few lines out of this six-page spreadsheet of 50 years of events at the center. The first two are Philip Kaplow, born in New Haven, Connecticut in 1912, Ralph Chapin, born in Batavia, New York in 1915. There is such a fascinating connection between these two, an affinity between these two. Some of you may not know that when Roshi Kaplow was still training in Japan in maybe 1952 or 1950, I don't know, when he was still training there, one Ralph Chapin, who always had a fascination with the Orient, with Asia, was in Japan and got to talking with expats who were living there, he had some smattering of interest in Zen, at least intellectually. And then he heard, what do you know? There is actually an American training in Zen there in Japan. And so he was eager to meet this American. And he found his way to the Kaplow apartment in Kamakura, Japan, was invited in. And there were the galley proofs of the Three Pillars of Zen spread out over the floor. It was shortly before it was published. And Ralph sat down and looked over a couple pages, and he said, looks very interesting. Here's a check. Would you send me 20 copies to Batavia, where I live? And with those 20 copies, he shared those 20 copies with this little nucleus of mostly women here in Rochester, a Vedanta-leaning group here in Rochester that included Doris and Chester Carlson and our own Audrey Fernandez, who I think is our last surviving founding member of the center, or charter member of the center. Anyway, he passed these out to this group of women and men, mostly women. And then, based on the group's reading of the Three Pillars, they were inspired, as so many thousands of people have been over the past 50 years, by reading the Three Pillars. And they invited this Philip Kaplow to come to Rochester. Kaplow was... these terms. This stage, he was just Philip Kaplow, so that's what I'm going to say. Kaplow was doing a short tour of the United States, sniffing out the possibilities of where he might want to settle to begin sharing with others this Dharma that he had been training in. And he went to California. He thought the environment there was not what he was looking for, and a couple other places. And then when he came here at the invitation of this group of mostly women, he found a group that he felt would work, He always said that there was a seriousness to the people here in Rochester that he hadn't sensed in the few other groups he'd been to in other parts of the country. And so he pulled up stake or laid down stakes here. There's a koan that flitted through my mind this morning that reminded me of this moment in 1966 when Philip Capuo established the Zen Meditation Center of Rochester. Here's how the koan goes. It's called, this is from the Shoyo Roku, the Book of Equanimity, in number 4. The Buddha points to the ground. When the Buddha was walking with his disciples, he pointed to the ground and said, "This would be a good place to build a temple." Indra, this is a mythological god from India. These koans don't have to be factual. They're just can be rich stories that make points about the Dharma. Indra took a stem of grass, stuck it into the ground, and said, "The temple is built." The Buddha smiled. So two perspectives. This here, rather than that there, this place, rather than that place, would be a good place to build a temple. But Philip Capuo, like any true teacher would know at the same time, yes, better Rochester than Southern California, let's say, but at the same time he would know that the temple is already built. It's always been built. Back to Philip Capuo and Ralph Chapin. We could say then, based on this chance encounter in Kamakura, that Ralph Chapin was the prime mover of the establishment of, other than Philip Capuo himself, the prime mover of the establishment of the Rochester Zen Center. Now, fast forward 30 years to our 30th anniversary, 1996. The trustees were ready, had actually, that was a trustees meeting. We had the trustees meet twice a year. That year, we scheduled the trustees meeting to be in the 30th anniversary and to meet on the 30th anniversary weekend. And they had ratified the funds to build a new zendo in the backyard here. I had felt increasingly that this zendo had its drawbacks in the summer, especially with the windows open and the sounds, the more and more noisy modern sounds coming in from where we were here right on the street. Not just the garbage trucks that always raised hell as soon as Taisho began, but the lawnmowers and motorcycles and leaf blowers and on and on and on. And it wasn't only that problem of noise here in this zendo, but other space issues. By building a zendo in the back of Arnold Park, where that grassy space is behind 5 Arnold Park, by building the zendo there, then this would open up this to be perhaps a much bigger meeting room, dining room area. And so I sold it to the trustees. They stamped it and said, "Okay, let's move ahead with it." Well, who was there that weekend but Ralph Chapin? And is actually the first time I'd ever seen him here at the Zen Center in Rochester. He stayed there out in Chapin Mill. He never was avid practitioner of Zen. But he happened to come for the 30th anniversary, having heard about this through mailings about this proposed new Zendo. And 3 days after that weekend, he called me and said, "I'd like to donate my estate, my country farm estate, to the Zen Center. Do you want it?" Well, I knew enough about process not to just say, "Yes, we'll take it." I said, "Absolutely, I want it, but Ralph, we need to run this by the Sangha." And so we called a Sangha meeting, and I outlined what all of you just heard about this stupendously generous offer from Ralph, and the everyone in attendance at the Sangha meeting, by acclamation or through a huge roar of the affirmative, signed off on it, and then having done that, having agreed to accept it from Ralph, then we can no longer. We had to build a retreat center. Why? Why did we have to? Well, not just because it was so difficult to accommodate all the people here in this Zendo for Sesshin, not just because it's noisy in the summer, but because we had been looking for property for Sesshin. There's this whole saga of Zen Center's karma with real estate, where we had started in the early 70s buying property outside the town of Honeoy, south of here, about 45 minutes from here, and we had actually started building some rude structures there, a couple of geodesic domes. working with landscaping on a pond and all. And then a few years passed, and we had a heart-to-heart Sangha meeting, and we all had to agree that Sangha just wasn't using it much. Maybe it was just a little bit too far to easily skip down there on a weekend. But there were other problems. This piece of property that we had, how big was it? Who do we know? 100 and what acres? Anyone know? Yeah, so over 100 acres. But we had gotten it pretty cheaply, and we then came to find out why it was relatively cheap there in the Finger Lakes, because it was the property was on a south slope. A north slope. South slope.
North slope.
So the growing season was considerably shorter than it would be on a south slope, and also that the soil was poor. There was poor drainage. And so each of these factors, the lack of use by the Sangha, the poor soil, the short growing season, the cold slope, the north, each of these factors together made us decide to sell the Honeoy land. But Roshi Kaplow still was wanting a place in the country, to hold sesshins and to have training, monastic training possibly, or at least residential training, where you're not stuck in the middle of a city with all of its temptations and commotion. And then his gaze turned way west to Colorado. And we bought mountain property in Colorado. And then we found out that we had this big problem with water rights, that we had a stream running through our property there that we had bought. It was raw land that we didn't start building, thank God. We learned by and by that water rights are a very complicated matter in the West because of the dry conditions. And you can have a stream running through your property and not be permitted to use it. They're senior water rights, junior water rights. Well, we are the lowest of the junior water rights, just based on seniority. And then while we were turning that over in our mind, then Roshi discovered Santa Fe and fell in love with Santa Fe. And so the trustees sold the Colorado property, and then we turned to Santa Fe. Any of you who haven't been to Santa Fe, it is like no other place in the country or maybe the world. And about that time, Roshi felt that he could turn over the center here, the management of the center, and the teaching responsibilities to his most senior developed disciple, Tony Packer. It was also, we were just bursting at the seams. There were people who sessions were so heavily oversubscribed. There would be times when we'd have to turn down 10, 15, 20, 25 people for sesshin. And so when Tony Packer started sharing teaching responsibilities, we increased the sesshins to 10 a year from the 6 that we had, 10 7 days, and the other shorter ones. And Roshi felt that he'd made good his escape to Santa Fe. We filled 2 moving vans and moved everything down there and bought a piece of property and started building. Well, it turns out that either, like any building project, there are a series of hoops you have to jump through, and the last hoop proved to be the one we couldn't get through, which was approval by the neighbors. Now, here's something about Santa Fe that you may or may not know, that everyone who moves to Santa Fe wants to be the last to move to Santa Fe. And so even though we had the foresight to go to Santa Fe with our moving vans brandishing a sheaf of letters from our neighbors here on Arnold Park recommending us, saying the nicest things about what we had done to the property here and the young men and women who were coming here, it didn't work. The neighbors of that piece of property ganged up on us and shot us down in the final approval that we needed from the neighbors. This is despite the local paper that had done more delving into our history, the local paper siding with us every step of the way and really urging the neighbors to welcome us. We made mistakes. Roshi Kaplow billed it as this international Zen center moving to Santa Fe. Well, Santa Fe is a small city. It's more of a town in its kind of soul. And people didn't want a big international Zen center from, God forbid, New York coming down there. And so we were shot down. Okay, you don't just quit after one failure. So we were, I don't know all the ins and outs, I can't remember, but we found another piece of property. I don't know if we started building or not, but the same thing happened. The last approval, the neighbor's approval, they shot us down. Now, right about this time, Tony Packer suddenly and shockingly decided that she could not teach here in a Buddhist context. I was in Mexico with Roshi that year. This is about 1981. He took a year sabbatical as plans were underway. All these things were going on in Santa Fe. And she called Roshi in Mexico and said, I need to come down to see you. And he said, well, you don't need to, because I'm going to be up there for a trustees meeting in a few weeks. And she said, no, I need to come down and see you. And so she came down. We watched them walk into the backyard of the house that Roshi was renting. And he came back in about half an hour later, I'll never forget the look on his face. It was this oddly serene look where he said, "She says she can't teach as a Zen Buddhist anymore." I bet some of you know this feeling where you're given such a shock and sort of everything kind of stops and you feel paradoxically tranquil. And that's the look I saw on Roshi's face. And he went back out and spent another hour or two with her. But her mind was made up. She had to do that. So then the biggest trauma, maybe too strong a word, the biggest shock in our 50-year history happened shortly after, when there was a meeting here and people aired their differences. By that point, Tony Packer had acquired so many students of her own that there was some heated words exchanged in the Buddha Hall here. And the upshot of it was that our mission, the Rochester Zen Center, our mission statement was that we teach and advance the Zen Buddhism. Not just Zen, but Zen Buddhism. And at that point, Tony was more than willing to go off and start her own center. And she went about 40 minutes south of here and opened what she called the Springwater Center. She died a few years ago. I don't know what the status of that center is. It was in a rural, it was small and rural. But this then, Roshi, with no one here, he felt was ready to be the teacher here, no one with the authority, no one who had been authorized to teach here. And with things crumbling in Santa Fe, they moved, they collected everything, moved the vans back here, and we dug in to pick up pieces. The fallout from this split between Tony Packer and Roshi Kaplow, between all her hundreds of students and his hundreds of students, fallout was such that for a while there, after the split, there was almost no one here. I remember a sitting, this is shortly after Roshi and I had returned from Mexico and things were pretty flat. I remember an evening sitting where no one came, and a formal sitting. That may not be so hard to understand now when it's mostly staff who come to our sittings, but there were almost no staff. There were only a few at the time, and I don't know where they were. All I know was I was head of the Zendo, and at 5 to 7 I went up to Roshi's room. It was what we now call the cork room, above the dining room, and he was putting his robe on, and I said, "Roshi, nobody's here. Should we cancel the sitting?" "Nope, we're not canceling the sitting." I think maybe someone showed up there, right, you know, as the big bell was being struck. But and then things grew over time. Roshi still felt that he needed to go into semi-retirement. And so in 1986, he asked me to succeed him. And he moved to Santa Fe for a while and then felt that he needed to go to Florida and then to really accelerate this. He was diagnosed with Parkinson's in 1991, and as he declined, we had to move him back up here to Rochester where he could be attended to, cared for full-time. I'm wandering a lot more than I thought I would. I haven't even looked at this spreadsheet I was going to use but I'm getting the main themes of all this. Another experiment that proved to be short-lived was monastic ordination. You know, when you hear about Zen centers in the United States having monks or calling themselves monasteries, this is a very casual use of the term. Traditionally, Buddhist monks took lifelong vows of celibacy and home leaving. That's the English translation, home leaving, which means you vow to never go home again, and to be celibate the rest of your life. And Roshi Kaplu always had a strong purity about him. By purity, I mean doing the pure, full octane kind of training. He found a couple of staff members here who convinced him that they wanted to do the traditional monastic ordination. So they took the monastic vows, celibacy, and all, but it just didn't work. To cut to the chase, we realized, and these are Roshi Kaplu's words, that monks belong in a monastery. This was never a monastery. We had hundreds of men and women, young men and women. And these two poor monks, 23-year-old monks, when I came here, when they became monks, almost all of us were in our early 20s. That was another amazing thing about what Roshi keeping this place going was. He was 35, 40 years older than all of us. Anyway, he became convinced that until we have a monastery in Hanoi or Colorado or Santa Fe, that we should adopt the Japanese system, which for the past, 100 years or so, has been, 140 years, has been that you become ordained, and then you have the option of getting married or not. And that's then I became Dane Gifford. Dane Zenson Gifford and I were ordained together. We were the first to be ordained as priests. I had myself convinced Roshi to ordain me as a celibate monk. And then I went into a sesshin and spent 7 days thinking about what I wouldn't be able to do as a celibate monk. What really occupied my mind the most that sesshin was that I couldn't visit my family again. It wasn't the woman thing so much. My first 10 years here I was celibate. I was demented about focusing on my koan and getting through my koan and continuing my koan training. But I came out of that sesshin and dragged myself to him and said, I can't do it. And he basically said, get out of here then. There was a period where Roshi was, when he was becoming so focused on these short-lived monks, that he found there was a place that people right across the street from us here on Arnold Park, the Millers, had a little country place outside of Rochester. We called it the Miller Place. And Roshi had decided that he wanted to devote his time to training monks. That was where his heart was. And this is the challenge of any Zen teacher, is finding a qualified successor. And he felt that the most likely successor he would have would be someone so committed as to have taken monastic vows. So he went out there. At that time, I hadn't been given the boot yet, and there were three or four of us who met, were living out there with him for just a few days, just as a kind of trial thing. And then and he was so happy to be out of all the problems here growing pains that he actually asked his senior, most advanced female student, Milda Vivada, to take over the center. Most people don't know this. This is back in 74 or something, early 73, 74, where he'd had it. He wanted to just train monks out in the country. And he asked her to take over the center, and she took a deep breath and said, "All right, hi, all right, I'll do it." She only lasted a few months. The strain of managing a large training center like this is maybe a topic for another day, but for me it was hard enough when I took over at the age of 38, but she was, what, 24? And these were all her peers? Her health began to suffer. And she had to leave. She felt she just had to leave. So there was Roshi again, pulled back like a yo-yo back to Arnold Park. Until then, he left Tony in charge, and then later me in charge. It takes a certain kind of person, a certain personality type of that, of someone who would found anything, or someone who would start a company, a founder. He got things going, and then things had stabilized enough when I took over. That then we could refine things and continue this endless process of adapting Zen to the West. We in the mid 70s we had a Japanese Roshi from Okinawa who had been friends with Kappo San in Japan. He came and visited for 3 days, and during that time there was a gathering where he took questions from us, and someone outlined all of these growing pains we were having, the many things, and he listened and listened and listened, and then his English was very limited, but all he said was, first 200 years the hardest. Well, those first 20 years were certainly, from my point of view, were much harder than the 30 years that I've been at the helm here. Chris Pauline is doing a project of doing a film about 50 years of the Zen Center. She has a cinematographer who will be wandering around next weekend during the celebrations, and she was asked by an editor, a very experienced editor, what the basic theme, what she saw the theme of this 50-year film, and she said, Roshi broke the eggs, meaning Kaplow broke the eggs, Kolheed made the omelet. And I had to say, I think that was a fair, if oversimplified, rendering of what these 50 years have been. There were a lot of eggs broken, those under Roshi, hurt feelings. Roshi was a pugnacious, pushy, aggressive, highly energetic, dynamic, creative teacher, and the chips fell all over the place. And one of the several big hopes we have for this weekend that's coming up is that those people who from the 60s and 70s for whom it was just too much under Roshi Kaplow. Those people who are coming back will have a different experience here this weekend. They will. They'll have a different experience if for no other reason that they're 40 years older, 30 or 40 years older, and they have the wisdom of hindsight to see what happened, why they needed to go through all that rigor that happened then. I'm so eager to see those people. We have about 150 from the 60s and 70s who do not carry enough resentments toward the center that they are coming back. And I look forward to showing them, to use a hackneyed phrase, a kindler, gentler center. Which doesn't mean a better center. There's pluses and minuses. There's pros and cons. And to the way Roshi taught and the way I'm teaching, the way the center it was then, the way it is now, there was a tremendous vitality that only comes from something growing, something new, youth that was there then that isn't here now. But on the other hand, there's, of course, a maturity now that wasn't there then, a stability. Well, my leg's getting sore, so the time is up. Let's stop and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the right way of Buddha. I vow attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain.